Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, our power grid is pretty complex and it faces a lot of problems, but researchers here in Wisconsin have a solution or some solutions that could take stress off our struggling grid. Here to talk with us, Gary Venkataramanan is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. Gary is also director of the Wisconsin Electric Machines and Power Electronics Consortium. So we'll talk with him, and I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about incorporating renewables into our power grid? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Gary, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Thank you so much. It's so such a pleasure to be here.
Well, you had the Wisconsin Electric Machines and Power Electronics Consortium. That's a mouthful, by the way. But what does that group do?
So we call it in short for us WEMPEC,
okay,
which is sort of an acronym. And it is a group of professors and students in the community here. We are supported to do research that are related to electric machines and power electronics from various companies around the country, around the globe. And it began in Wisconsin with two or three companies in Milwaukee, Wisconsin area to support research and education in that area. And it has grown over 40 years now. We're 42 years old now.
Boy.
And we have about 60 companies that are members of the consortium all around the world. They're interested in our research and education to make the power utilization, generation, everything better.
Yeah. You mentioned power electronics. Some people may not know what that is. So what are power electronics?
Yeah. Electronics is something we all get used to. Our cell phone that are in our pockets, the computer we use, iPads, and all kinds of equipment we use, and also television and this radio that we're speaking through. All that system is all electronics that's related to communications and informations. There is another field of electronics that is used for controlling power. That has to do with lighting, that has to do with motors, that has to do with wind turbines, electric vehicles. So electronics are used widely in those places as well, controlling your elevator. You press the button, elevator comes to you. There are electronics behind all of those, and Wisconsin has been a pioneer in that field for decades now, and we continue that tradition today. And that's what power electronics is.
Let's talk about the power grid for a minute. You know, and I think it'd be worth talking about how electricity actually reaches our homes.
Oh, yes. Oh, we can talk about this for 3 days, all in end, and we'll never be done. So, well, let's talk about the very conventional way of generating electricity and bringing it to our homes. And it's usually some power plant. I'll take a hydropower plant, water that's behind a dam, that is sent through pipes to turn a turbine. And the turbine is connected to an electric generator. It's called an alternator. And it converts the energy that is stored in the water into electricity. And then it's carried through wires. And the level at which this is transmitted through big towers and wires running across them, you see them when you drive across highways, they come to a location closer to our homes called a substation. The availability of this electricity, the level of them is sort of, you think about them as a pressure regulator. They're reduced to the level that is convenient for us to use. And then there are lines that come to our backyard, our front yard, mm-hmm. and then sent to our homes. And we use that electricity for doing whatever we want to do.
Yeah. Just as an aside on the... The Wisconsin River was at one time called the workingest river in the country because of the dams and the power sources coming from the Wisconsin River.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the hydropower is considered among the most renewable of these energy sources. But today we have many other forms of energy that we draw from, solar and wind and various other forms.
So what are the problems facing the grid right now?
Well, I would say the biggest threat we see is all these changes that are due to climate change. We see a lot of disturbances in the grid that we have not been used to in the past, ice storms and various other hurricanes and tornadoes. They are coming in more frequency at many times of the year where we have to deal with lots of load that are drawn by customers. And it's the hottest day, and that is when the grid is stressed, and that's when everybody wants their air conditioners on. So we're hitting the limits on what the grid can do. And there are various other things that are ongoing, the incorporation of sun, solar energy into the grid, wind energy into the grid. All of them are putting strain on the grid. We're used to running a generator 24/7, maybe put them down for maintenance a couple of times a year or things like that. But these forms of energy that's coming from wind and solar are varying with time as the weather changes. And that is something our system is not used to. And that is something we're working on, how to prepare ourselves, how to operate the grid in the presence of all of these varying resources.
Yeah, that's an interesting question to have answered for sure. Josh in Eau Claire has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Hey, I had a question about the ability of the grid to handle the influx of electric vehicles. I'm an electrician in Eau Claire. I've been installing a lot of car chargers that draw a continuous 50 amps on Teslas and other vehicles. And most homes are only drawing a continuous, maybe 20 amps, 30 amps at 240 volts. But everybody puts in one of these car chargers, and it could be substantial increase in the demand. And I've talked to Xcel Energy or some of their linemen, and they've questioned the same thing, whether their system can handle it. And I've got a question about that.
Oh. Yeah, thank you, Josh, for that question. Very important question and a good question. And several people are switching to electric vehicles, and they're growing in numbers and as a share of new vehicles that are being sold. And people are expecting them to almost reach a bigger share of the market. And some of people have garages. They have charging things that are putting in there that are being put in the garages. Homes have typically have 200 amp circuits. They can feed them. However, if everybody charges their vehicles at the same time, we might see overloading of the transformer, overloading of the distribution system. And there are utility engineers and researchers who are working towards how to manage that. And so there are several ways of doing that. So first thing that's happening is several utilities are strengthening their distribution grid, replacing transformers, upgrading their voltage levels and wiring so that we can take additional loads that are being drawn from these circuits. But other than that, at homes, even if the chargers are plugged in all the time, what most people studies are showing that people are going to top off a little bit after they drove for the day. So the amount of energy that they need on a daily basis is going to be limited, and it won't have a huge impact. And there's opportunities we have, particularly with the new emerging technologies of smart grids and communications between the home and the grid, that can be used so that they're not being all charged at the same time. You can stagger them. Some of them are charging around. Some of them charge 5 minutes later. So there's something that we all have to get used to. But the operating protocols are being developed now so that we'll be able to smoothly move into that. I mean, this is not going to happen overnight. The new vehicles are going to come in. The old vehicles have a lifetime of 20 years, 30 years, depending on how often you buy new vehicles. So I would say that our utility engineers, researchers, federal government, all together are working towards making this transition smooth and won't be a huge trouble for us. The bigger problem is for us to deal with the intermittency and climate change. Things like that are expected to be bigger than these electric vehicle introductions. And in fact, the introduction of electric vehicles are going to expect us to make it easier because each electric vehicle has batteries in them. You can store energy in them and take them out later. You have a flexibility of when you can charge. So it is going to be part of the solution, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks a lot, Josh, for calling. Does that help?
Very much. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to ideas@WPR.org. John emailed that one of the benefits gained by converting radiant solar energy to electricity is the ability to transmit electrical power over copper cables to our homes and businesses, mostly for use as heat or cooling and light. However, concentrated radiant solar power could also be transmitted over light pipes and optical cables without the intermediate step of converting it to electricity. Is there anybody at our university campuses investigating the possibilities of transmitting concentrated radiant energy over optical cables? And if so, where?
On our campus, I'm not aware of any activity in that field, but I do know that you can buy these devices that you can put on the ceiling that capture light, and then they send it through an optical pipe down to, let's say, for instance, if you want a daylight in your basement, and you can install this in the ceiling of your basement, and you can get daylight in there. So there's some work going on. NASA did a bunch of work on it, and there are products you can buy today to bring daylight into your basement that use these so-called light pipes. But we do have other faculty members in our department. They're working on, I would say, thermosolar generations and other type of nanotechnologies that are used to build solar cells that can take a lot of concentrated solar radiation that could include not only light waves but also heat waves at the outside the visible spectrum of sunlight. And not only from sun, from various other heat sources as well. So we have a new faculty member join our department named Professor Eric Turwell. He came from National Renewable Energy Lab, joined our faculty just about a year ago. And they're setting up their labs. And it's an area of active research, I would say, broader spectrum of solar technologies that include well beyond what we're using today.
Oh, interesting. Gary Venkataraman. Our guest today, he is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@WPR.org. Clara Neipert, our producer today, our on-air producer, Jill Nadeau, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Gary Venkataraman, our guest today here on the Ideas Network, professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at, our energy update. We haven't gotten into microgrids much yet, but we'll get there with Gary. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Leo in Milwaukee. Leo, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, well, I am an electrical engineer. I have 2 degrees in different forms of engineering. And something I would like to point out that I don't think has been mentioned yet, and that is that generators are constant torque, constant load devices, which means if you've got a 1 megawatt generator, it's going to put up 1 megawatt at all times. It's not like you have a dimmer switch that you can turn it off. And that power has to go somewhere. Sometimes you use it. Sometimes it's just wasted as heat. And so what you really need to focus on, I think, is storage technology of various types, batteries, supercapacitors, whatever, in order to store the energy at times when you're not using it, regardless of where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you, Leo, for pointing that out. We have various forms of energy, flywheel energy storage, battery energy storage, pumped hydro energy storage, superconducting electric machines. But of course, batteries are ubiquitous, big forms of energy storage. And we're seeing huge investments that are going on utility scale storage and various other things. And all of these are, in fact, fueled by what's happening in the automotive industry. The battery technology is developing quite fast. And it is not going to be too far away that we will all have perhaps a small tank of electricity, so to speak, in our own homes to ride through conditions in which we may not have electricity mm-hmm. grid that is breaking away because of some weather-related problem or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Dream
yeah.
on.
Yeah, dream on. Leo, thank you. Christina in Glenwood City, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I will soon be replacing my HVAC system. So based on this discussion and what's coming down the pike, I'm wondering if you have any suggestions about what we should consider for maximum efficiency.
How old is your furnace, Christina?
Oh, my gosh. It's probably 25 years old. And for the past 3 years, it's been running on a part that's been superglued.
Well, super, Gary, that probably helps a little bit.
Yeah, duct tape and super glue, so many furnaces going around like that. So I'm glad you're considering replace them. If it's 25 years old, it's not going to be very efficient. And the replacement, I think one of the technologies that are people that are promoting, I'm not a HVAC engineer by any means, but I'll tell you these air source heat pump-based systems are considered to be among the most efficient. They work as an air conditioner in the summer and a heater in the winter. And so it is two-in-one device that allows you to make the most efficient use of these thermodynamic systems. However, one needs to be careful because the heating cycle, they're not very effective when the temperature gets too low, like sometimes we see in Wisconsin, 30 below with the wind chill. So there is a limit at which how well they can heat at very, very low temperatures outside. But if you're able to figure out that window of opportunity there, you may be able to downsize, have a small conventional furnace and an air source heat pump. In fact, I have something like that in our home. That because I have two systems, when one of them falls apart, I can use the other one to provide me right through. Mm-hmm. And it was 2 years ago, I think in March, we had that polar vortex cold wave. Our furnace failed. And I had to do a bunch of research to figure out how to equip ourselves. And I went to a system that is dual active so that I'll have redundancy. Even with one fails, I'll have the other one riding through me.
Yeah, I've got a geothermal unit in our home, 480-foot holes in the ground that bring up the heat. But there's also the gas option that comes along with it. So
absolutely, absolutely.
So, Christina, and it installs, I mean, it looks like the old kind of like the air conditioner that used to sit outside on the ground next to the house, those heat pumps, right?
Yeah, they are, right.
Yeah. There you go, Christina. It's something to consider. And I would also say I believe there are some energy dollars available through the, I mean, you might go to the Focus on Energy program for that.
Depending on the state of your house, you may even consider some sort of a radiant heating system.
Yeah.
They are a lot more effective than the blowing air across and other things. So I would say Focus on Energy would be a good place to start. And they allow you to do an energy audit of your home. And they pay for that. And then you can get a most effective and the optimal system that's suitable for your home.
I'd look into that, Christina. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. In fact, the Focus on Energy folks, I'm reminded by Jill, are with us on Thursday at 11:45. So it's nice to know that they'll be here to talk some more about the program, because there's a lot going on, especially starting this year, with ways for you to save money when it comes to your home and its heating and cooling. Kay in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I had worked with an engineer cousin of mine on these kinds of ideas, and could you, is there anybody individually putting up like solar panels on their carport roof or house roof and then just running that heat into batteries to at least charge your car batteries, or maybe an outside generator if you lose your electricity, or your refrigerator if you lose your, or freezer if you lose your electricity? Is that conceivable? Anybody doing that?
Yeah. Resiliency and use of solar and storage is becoming a very important part of our emerging future. And in fact, I want to tell you a little story here. At Eagle Heights in the UW camp, near the UW campus, we have a prairie called the Biocore Prairie, where we have a lot of the botany and agriculture and gardening students, horticulture students do work there. And we just installed a type of system you just spoke about. There is a little solar panel with a shed in there. And the energy from the solar panels are used to charge electric bicycles there. And as you know, Eagle Heights is up the hill, and it is a good ride. It can get your hearts pumping when you're going up there. So e-bikes are very, very becoming very popular everywhere. So we had this system that was rigged together by one of our graduate students on campus to charge the e-bikes using solar panels. And these are small enough, and you can conceivably put something near your garage, something like that. And if you're interested, give me a send me an email. I can get you connected with a student that are working in there. My email address is giri@engr.wisc.edu. Or also you can search for me under the name G-I-R-I. I'm probably the only one in the state of Wisconsin with that spelling.
And the last name, probably. Not too many with that last. Van Kataramanan. I had to say that about 40 times before the show today, and I still mess it up once already, Geary.
Well, Larry, people just call me Geary, or sometimes Professor Geary, or just V.
Okay. Well, if you want to talk to Geary, you can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org. Steve emailed to ask why portions of the electric grid are privatized. Wouldn't it be more efficient to have the federal government control the grid? Wouldn't that save money?
Oh, my God. Oh, that is a very, very charged question. I'm not sure if I should try to take that. There are countries where the entire electricity grid is operated by the government. I grew up in India, so all the electricity system is operated by the government there. There's a central electricity board, and each state has their own electricity board. I will tell you, there are lots of efficiency factors that come about between private agencies operating certain networks versus public agencies operating certain networks. And I can tell you from my experience, I would prefer the private ownership model for electricity supply. I'm just telling you my visceral response, and there's a lot of a lot of people who can tell more about it, the people who are public utility economists across the board. And in the U.S., obviously, there are various systems under which we ensure a very, very reliable electricity network that includes state agencies and regulatory agencies of different states. And we also have the Federal Energy Regulatory Body. And all put together, we have a very, very reliable system. Any of you who have traveled in any of the places where you cannot take availability of electricity for granted. And so I don't want to dig myself into a ditch any deeper than I am in now. What do you say, Larry?
All right. On that comment, we go to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and quite a while ago we bought a very low-end electric vehicle. It's a neighborhood electric vehicle. and it runs on 8 batteries, regular size batteries. However, if one battery goes not so good, you have to replace all of them. Of course, that is quite expensive. It's a very simple car. Its top speed is 18 miles an hour. It has a governor on it. But it's actually fun to drive, and it is what it says. It's a neighborhood electric vehicle, and as I get older, I know this car, because of the windows all around it, and it's small, it's going to be very easy to drive as an older person, which I am becoming. But my question is whether we will be able to look forward to some other source of energy than the batteries, which, of course, we have a recharging station in our garage, which MG&E put in for free for us. Otherwise, we could not have afforded this.
Hmm.
And also, I do have a brother-in-law that suggested, well, perhaps you can put solar on this car, Karen. But anyway, do you know of anything we can be look forward to?
Yeah.
Because it's so simple. I mean, it requires no gas, no oil, not a carburetor, there's not a radiator, there's not...
There's just those darn 8 batteries.
That's right, that's right. So I don't know what vintage and neighborhood electric vehicle that you have there.
Sounds pretty old.
The batteries today are a lot more effective on storing energy and giving it back when you need. So next time one of the batteries goes bad, you may want to consider retrofitting them with newer generation batteries. That's first thing I would say. The second thing is just like the question, I think Kay asked about having a small solar panel for charging it. You could consider putting a small solar panel if you have the space in your yard and have a charging system to charge your NEV. And that will alleviate having to charge into the MG&E system. It can probably, I wouldn't know... your driving cycle to understand how much you can get in the winter versus summer. You have to do a little bit more detailed study to figure out something that works reliably through the year. But it's possible that you may not ride this a lot in the winter time.
Although it's a community car, so a lot of different people are driving it. So it may be getting
Absolutely.
A fair amount of use.
Yeah.
Is there a time when Karen and her community might consider a new one?
Absolutely. There are newer neighborhood electric vehicles that are coming into the market, and some startup companies are making newer vehicles, and it may be possible for us to... I mean, there's also schemes that are being put forth in place for what is called the last mile, from the bus to your home or from a train station mm-hmm. to your home. These electric scooters and e-bikes, NEVs, or as they're called, neighborhood electric vehicles, are considered a part of the transportation solution for us in the future. I would say there will be more options available as we look towards our future.
Karen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Milwaukee, we're on to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Hi there. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Say, we have a house here on the south side of Milwaukee, close to Cold Spring Road, and we have a fair amount of groundwater. Here, and some pump runs a lot. I wonder if there's any way we can harness maybe the heat energy or the cooling possibilities of that water. But it's always pump it and throw it out in the yard. But before we do that or on its way to the yard, maybe is there something we can do there maybe?
Hmm.
Let me think. So the sump pump is getting water that is quite likely seeping in from the basement.
From the floor, probably.
From the floor. I would say the temperature of that water is not too, will not have a huge differential between the local temperature. Typically, if you want to extract energy out of these thermal sources, you need to have a differential temperature. And if you're getting it close to the surface, maybe 5-10 feet from the basement, you're not going to get a whole lot. The geothermal, geosource heat pumps typically drill down several hundred feet in order to get that differential. At least that is my initial reaction, but Larry has 180 holes in his yard.
He may 180 be able foot to hole.
That's right.
Well, I'm not near the water like I was. But the water, well, from 180 foot down, the temperature that comes up from those pipes is 55 degrees. So you're looking at heating and cooling starting at 55 degrees. And so, and especially cooling, it's really inexpensive to cool. You have to kind of warm the hot water, the air up a bit before it comes through. But I do remember living on Lake Monona here, and we had water just underneath our basement, just very similar to what Mark's got. And that water was coming up. The differential, you're right, the differential on that would have been not enough to be able to figure out a system that's going to help you.
It's very low-grade heat, as they call it.
Yeah, very low-grade. Thanks, Mark. Lester in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Lester. Lester, are you there? Lester, well, let me just... His question was, how much do you get back when selling to the grid? And that depends on where you are in the state.
Yeah, there are net metering and various regulatory arrangements available in different parts of the state or different utility companies. You enter into a contract with your utility on that. And so the terms are different for depending on where you live. Yeah.
Yeah. Microgrids. We haven't really talked much about microgrids, and here we got about 5 or 6 minutes left.
Absolutely. Maybe we'll be able to speak about it for a few minutes. So this, the electricity grid in the United States and most other countries is very centralized. All of the generation devices, load devices, are all interconnected together into a network that, so as to say, is a heart that beats together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all connected together through wires. And we have, I would say, three heartbeat systems going on in the country, the Western United States, the Eastern United States, and, of course, Texas on their own. And so these systems are all operating in synchronism as a single entity. They're all beating together. Imagine you're driving around, all the cars are tied together, tethered to each other, towing each other, pushing each other, and pulling each other. That's the type of grid we operate today. And in the future, we think that as more solar and more wind and more electric vehicles and more storage devices come in, it'll be better for us to break this grid down into smaller operating units that we call microgrids that could be size of your community, size of a town, size of a city, or size of a state. It allows you to exchange energy across the boundaries, but each of them operates as a single entity that gives more controllability, I would say more agility. And that is a concept that is slowly gaining interest among the academic community and also the federal government, Department of Energy, Department of Defense. So there's interest growing here, but we're not ready for it. It's going to take decades for us to get there. But there are pilot installations that are being planned, that are ongoing, demonstrations that are going in. The demonstration systems that have been put in East Coast, West Coast, internationally, they've all demonstrated during catastrophic events, they've been able to drive right through and provide critical power needs. Some of the notable examples are the Fukushima nuclear reactor, when there was a nuclear failure there. The microgrid was continuing to provide power for the critical equipment there. When Hurricane Sandy hit on the East Coast, we had several locations that were operating as microgrids that would continue to keep the lights on. So we have case studies on the ground that are demonstrating that it's possible. So technically it's feasible, but we have to figure out a lot of other regulatory protection, operation, ownership, responsibility centers, and moving towards that.
You mentioned international and got me thinking about, you know, there are places where electricity would be nice for people to have. And I'm just wondering about the barriers, or how do we get electricity to everybody around the world?
Yes, energy access is a very important question. And the new technologies that are coming in with solar energy, wind energy, batteries together with a small amount of fossil fuel inputs, we're able to operate small grids in remote locations without having to build large-scale infrastructure, transmission systems. There are people who claim that if we were to build an electricity system, we will build it very differently compared to what we did 100 years ago. And that is built on the basis of renewable energy generation and storage and the microgrid technologies. The world will look very different. I mean, you can think about the relationship we have between wireless mobile phones today versus the wired phones that we were all used to just about 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of transformation, we've just sort of stranded a lot of the communication infrastructure we used to have. We're not ready to do that with electricity yet. But in newer locations where we don't have access today, this may be a way for us to get there.
Well, this has been a real pleasure, Gary. And I hope you can come back and be with us again sooner than the distance between our last visits. Will you do that for us?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to our next visit already. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Gary. Gary Venkataramanan, professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. Didn't really get to talk to him about all the research that he's been involved in, so maybe we get him back sooner than later and talk about that and talk some more about getting electricity to you and to me and everybody else in the world. Well, coming up next, I don't know about you, but I had sore shoulders on Sunday morning from all the darn shoveling, and Steve Ackerman, it's his fault, I'm pretty sure. One of our weather guys, he's up next. I'm Larry Wheeler for the Ideas Network.